right. Happy Friday, everyone. Once again, I'll just go over a couple of items. Just wanted to welcome you to our conference call today. And then I also wanted to review with you, if you do go to our website, baylark.com, you can download the slides after clicking on that banner to follow along via the slideshow there. To raise your hand at the end, we will have questions and answers. So just hit 5-star, and we'll go down as we get them and answer any and all questions, if there are any. So, Charles?
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining our conference call with college funding expert John Hupalo from Invite Education and My College Corner. John and I have worked together for a number of years on a number of different projects, and we're always finding valuable insight and resources from each other. And so it's great for John to have to be on the call with us today. John, are you there, sir?
I am. Good afternoon.
Fantastic. Thanks for joining us, John. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Charles. Appreciate being here.
Happy to have you, sir. So John is a nationally recognized expert in education, loan finance, and college planning, and he's the co-author of Plan and Finance Your Family's College Dreams from Peterson's Publishing in 2016. He's the host of My College Corner podcast and regularly speaks on issues related to saving, planning, and paying for college at conferences, both television, radio, and in print. And prior to founding Invite Education up in Boston, he's worked on Wall Street and served as the Senior Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of a New York Stock Exchange-listed company. And the hot topic of the moment right now is all these award letters that are coming in for all of our folks. And I know that as we're out meeting with our families and clients, we're seeing that a lot of award letters and offer letters are hitting from the colleges in the last week or two. And it's always great to have some outside insight to help us interpret that. I also just want to share with you that on the Valark website, valark.com, we have a tab called the Resource Center. And if you pull up the Resource Center, one of our resources is the Valark College Planning Center, which is one of the tools that John and his company produce. So if you'd like to get more access to John's materials, you can do that through our website at valark.com. John, I know you have some slides prepared for us today, and I'll let you take it away from here, sir.
Thanks so much, Charles, and good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining. Charles asked me to talk today about the financial aid award letters in particular, but I wanted to broaden that a little bit to discuss not only the award letters themselves, but how to appeal the award letters, and then importantly, how to use this entire process to try to minimize any college loans, either student loans or parent loans that might be necessary. So I thought first we'd just go through and talk about the financial aid package. So I've moved, for those of you with the slides, to the financial aid award letter where we talk about the package. And all these packages, financial aid award letters, have basically three components to them. They are structured differently. Every college has a different format and all that sort of thing. But really, when you boil it down, there are three parts that you should be aware of. One, is the good stuff, the free money, that's grants and scholarships. The second is earned money, which is basically on a financial aid award letter, shows up as work study. And then the third part is a component of loans. And frankly, I don't think of that as aid because obviously you need to repay that with interest. But when a school does package a financial aid award letter, they are permitted. In fact, the government lets them put the loan package in as part of that. I want to next go to the next slide, and the title of that slide for those who are following is How Much Do You Need? And what this is an actual financial aid award letter that we've redacted. This award letter, like most of them, says, congratulations, you're now been accepted to our school, and we're pleased to provide you with this financial aid award package. And then there's a list of stuff. And what we did on this slide is unpack that for you. We wanted to show you the free money, the grants and the scholarships. And so in this award package, that's the green box with those with the slide. So that's about $28,000 worth of aid, which is grants and scholarships. For one great tip related to grants and scholarships, it's important for you to understand the fine print related to those grants and scholarships. For instance, the questions you should be asking, is this grant or scholarship for 1 year or is it for multiple years? What do you need to do to maintain that particular scholarship or grant? So I would definitely dig in to understand the grant award itself. And the award letter that we're showing, the scholarship and college grant is what's known as institutional aid. So that came directly from the college. And then below that, we see federal Pell Grant and federal SEOG grant. So that's from the federal government packaged here as part of that award. And again, it's in a green box because it's great. There are no strings attached other than what other requirements might be to qualify. But you don't need to repay that, and you don't need to do anything more to earn that. Directly below that green box is a red box that shows $5,500 in prepackaged federal direct subsidized and unsubsidized student loans. And just below that is the work-study eligibility. And the work-study eligibility has two asterisks, which tells you that this is not guaranteed and does not reduce your financial aid bill. What it is a job, basically, at the school, so the student can go and earn that particular money. In this case, it's $2,000. We call that earned aid. One note on the financial aid eligibility around work study, you don't have to accept that job. In fact, if you can find, or the student can find, a better paying job or something that fits their interests more, you can not accept this work study eligibility award. So that's the way the package is set up. Again, free money, loans, and then work-study eligibility. And it's important for you to understand when you see your financial aid award letter for your student, what components fall into which category. There will also be a total, and the one on the slide is $36,000 of total aid. May sound like a lot of money. Maybe it's not, though. When I look at that green arrow that shows a total of $36,000, then I look at the second arrow to the left. It says your estimated remaining cost is $18,626. So I want to take a moment and pause and say that if you add the estimated remaining cost of a little over $18,000 to the total aid of $36,000, that's what's known as the sticker price. So about $54,000 is the total cost of this school. The net price, and some you will know that term, the net price to this family, so that's the sticker price less financial aid, is about $18,000. Now, this, again, is for 1 year. So the school is saying to you, in order to pay tuition and all the rest of it, it's going to cost you another $18,000 beyond what they were able to provide. The next slide, though, enumerates two other facts, and that is, in addition to the net price to attend the school, there are other miscellaneous fees, expenses, books, travel that comprise the total cost. So my caution to you is look past the net price or even the sticker price and understand how far your student's going from home, what the travel might be, what books may be required, miscellaneous expenses. For those of you following on the slide, you see that we added about $2,300 of additional expenses. That number could be significantly more or it could be less depending on your particular circumstance. But the total cost, and this is really the point of the slide, the total cost that we're solving for is $21,000 that needs to be made up for this next academic year. The next slide turns to ways to pay that bill. So how are we going to pay that $21,000? The basic components are I'm going to say free money from the perspective of it's the family savings, potentially some current income. When a student leaves the house, and in my case I had two girls, when they left the house, our disposable income increased because they weren't living at home, they weren't eating, they weren't driving the car, taking gas, all that. So you're going to see a little bump up in your disposable income, so you may allocate some of that to pay some of the bill. There are also other scholarships and other free money. It's never too late, including for students in college, to go and try and find some additional scholarships. The opportunity to earn additional scholarships and other free money is possible. For those on the slide, there's a blue box to the right that says payment plans. We'll talk a little bit more about payment plans in a moment, but To me, this is one of the uncovered gems in the possible way to reduce student loans if you use a payment plan. We'll talk about that in a moment, as I said. The last on this list in the bottom in red, student loans and parent loans. And I've long thought that is absolutely critical for parents and students to think of loans as the last resort and not the first option to pay the college bill. And that's why we put them at the bottom of this slide. We also have a slide following that says find the free money. And we assigned just actually randomly some amounts of money for parent savings, maybe a gift from a grandparent, a national prize a student may have won, a local scholarship, and some student savings totaling about $13,000. For those on the slide, we're precise to say it's $13,246. And then when you look to the right, there's a gauge that says the total amount that we're trying to cover is $20,926. When you subtract out the free money, that leaves an unmet need, an unfilled gap of $7,680. And the next slide says, now what? I owe $7,680. Now you'll appreciate why we manufactured the numbers the way we did. And that is the slide that says, now what? I owe $7,680 shows another insert from a financial aid award letter that actually provided guidance to this family for their unmet need of $7,680. And what this guide said was that there were really four options that the family had to fill that gap of $7,680. I'm going to go to the next slide, and this is the one on payment plans now. And this school said, and many schools have programs like this, that they have a payment plan in place. And the way the payment plan generally works is that for a fee, in this one it's a $50 enrollment fee per semester, the company, the payment plan company, will advance the money to the college. So if you wanted $7,680 in total, they would advance $7,680, and then you, as the parent or the student, could make payments either monthly for 10 months or semi-annually. And this is a fairly common way that the payment plans are structured. I'll also say that in this option, they assume that you would want to use the payment plan for the full $7,680. You could choose to make a payment plan of $2,000 or $3,000 or any amount of money that made sense for your income. And again, it goes back to the point I made earlier, which is that it's highly likely your disposable income will increase. You'll have a few more dollars around as a result of not having the student living at home. And I think that the payment plan option is better for those families that have that opportunity than to just pile on more additional student loan debt. For parents who are in need of a loan, the next slide talks about the two basic options that come for parent borrowing. And again, this came from the school. They said that option three was the Federal PLUS loan, and then option four was a private loan. And on our slide, it says Federal PLUS, be wary. And the reason I think you need to be careful around the Federal PLUS loan is this. First, there's an origination fee, which is very high. It's over 4%. Second, there's a very minimal credit test. Really just no adverse credit, which is a very, very low bar in the credit scale. So that can be an issue for families. It's sometimes too easy to get this. And I say that because there's no real cap on the borrowing. The federal government will lend you up to the cost of attendance. So they're not doing a credit check. They're not checking to see what your income might be, whether you have the wherewithal to make these payments, but they'll lend you the money. So I think that that's a very dangerous situation for some families. The private loan, option four on this, is a different animal in that it is credit-based. So you can go and Google private loans, and you'll find 5 or 10 different lenders that will make a decision about your credit based on your income and other attributes, just as if they would make a decision on a mortgage or an auto loan. The next slide has two other options, and we have in parens on the slide that we don't love. The two options are retirement and credit card. Before I get to that, let me say that some families do dip into home equity. And that could actually be a good alternative for some families. I was on a panel very recently, though, where an expert in all of consumer finance made the point that retirement products and home equity products and student savings products are all really structured to meet that particular need. And the home equity product in particular is really structured for a rainy day fund in lots of ways. If there's a problem with your home or maintenance or something like that where you have that emergency cash. And their point was if you take that emergency cash out to pay for college, you've really taken away a potential option that you might need down the road. So home equity could work for some families, but I think there's some caution there. Some families also think that going and taking a loan against their 401k is a good option. I happen to think that's not a great option. Generally, parents who are have a robust enough or a good enough sized 401k, if they borrow against that when their children are off to college, you're really taking a good amount of that corpus, the principal amount of that 401k at a really critical time when you want to be earning as much as you can during that period. So I'm not a big fan of 401k borrowing. Some folks think it's a great idea because you get to pay yourself back the interest. That's the argument that I hear mostly. I just happen to think that there are better ways to borrow for college than raiding a retirement account. So I'm not a big fan of that. And then finally, credit cards. You hear this all the time that somebody wants to go and, you know, get the cash back or rewards or points or whatever it might be for the credit card borrowing itself. And my only point on that is as long as you can make the full payment in the next month when that credit card bill comes due, that could actually be, you know, a fine option for you. But don't find yourself in the position of putting $10,000 on your credit card, not making that full payment the next month, and then all of a sudden you're paying 15 or 20 or 24% interest on effect what was a loan to help pay for college. The last two points I want to make, one is we saw a financial aid award letter for the first year of college. Just remember there are at least three more years for most students coming. Unfortunately, many students go a fifth or a sixth year, so this idea of planning ahead, looking at the four-year picture, not just the first-year picture, is really important. Understand how much family contributions can be made during that time, how much free money may be gotten. Think about how you could use those payment plans over the course of those 4 years, all with an idea of trying to minimize the student loan and the private loan borrowing that may need to be done. And then finally, the second to last slide for those of you who are following along, we said that student loans should be the last resort, not the first option. Again, I don't think it's a great idea to endanger your retirement to send the child to college. And then finally, allocating those scarce savings wisely over the course of a number of years is generally helpful. Before I open it to questions, Charles, I'll just touch on the point about financial aid award letters and what happens when they're not enough. So this idea of negotiating an award letter. In our book, Planet Financial Families College Dreams, we dedicated some ink to this, and what we said there was that you really can't go and negotiate per se like you were negotiating the price of a car. What you really do need to do, though, is go and if the financial aid award letter is not adequate, you could go back and let the school know that you may have gotten more aid from another school, or perhaps your circumstances have changed, and that's really the best way to make what I'll say is an appeal. Again, an appeal, but not a negotiation with a particular school. And there's a term of art called special circumstances, and this is the best avenue to go back to a school to ask for more financial aid. Perhaps since the papers were filed, the FAFSA was filed back in October the year prior. So for seniors right now, or those of you who've just gotten your aid award letters, you filed that FAFSA form that was available on October 1st. Perhaps there's been a change in the circumstance since that tax year from your filing that you'd want to bring up and let the school know about that. The other, oftentimes, there may be an error in the FAFSA filing itself that you didn't catch. The school will help you determine all of that. So the best advice when it comes to appealing for more aid is to know that you're making an appeal. The school will try to help if they can, but for the most part, unless there's special circumstances that have changed the facts around your filing, it becomes a difficult task to try to get significantly more money from a college from the financial aid world. So, Charles, we said we'd try to do this in about 20 minutes or so, and I think we got through in that time frame. I'd be happy to see if we can answer some questions.
Yeah, thanks, John. Appreciate that. I'm going to just follow on to a couple of the points that you made, and then we'll open it up to the floor if that's all right. You know, I agree with you about the negotiating and appealing. You know, maybe negotiating isn't the right word. It is appealing, I suppose, whatever merit or scholarship decisions you've received from the school. And we talk about in our seminars that there are four appealable points. In other words, four places that you can gain traction on. And the first is unmet need. If mathematically the cost of attendance minus the support package they've provided still provides, you know, a shortfall, then that's one of the biggest things that you can appeal. Second is unusual achievement. We're really looking to bring forth all of the outstanding achievements of that student. And, you know, a lot of times these achievements are not showing up on the college application or the essay or whatnot. And a great example here is Eagle Scout. Or if you're in the Civil Air Patrol, maybe the Spats Award, or Captain of the Debate Team, or First Chair Trumpet, or volunteer in the community, we really want to bring forward what an outstanding student at school would be getting if they could just provide a little bit more support. Third, and I think you touched on this, is financial circumstances. Was there something challenging financially that happened in the family that might make it difficult to pay and save for school? And great examples here is maybe there was a layoff, or somebody has a business that's struggling because of whatever's going on in the economy, or maybe a health crisis, or grandma came to live with us and now we're caregivers. But anything that we can, you know, divorce is sometimes an issue. We often see, sadly, dads who vanish and leave the mom to pay, and you know, that's unfortunate. We want to bring those stories forward. And then finally is competition between schools, and we do recommend that people apply to enough schools that they have enough offers that they can compete one against the other. Now I can tell you, and John, maybe you have experience on this you can talk to as well, is that schools are kind of getting wise to this whole process, and they will say things like, sure, we'll negotiate after you send in your non-refundable deposit. And is this some of the stuff you're seeing as well, John?
Charles, we do see some of that, and you know, one of the points that I think is just critical is that you highlighted this beautifully, is that this is a business decision, and I think too many families think of this as, well, you know, the school is going to be paternalistic and maternalistic, and look, they gave me $36,000, that's a lot of money, they really want my student to be here. And just to remember that the school's position is they want to give you the least amount of financial aid they can to get you to come to the school. That's their business. And your point is, as a smart consumer, you go with facts in hand and competition, and then you have an opportunity then to be more successful in the process. But just know that there is they don't want to call it a negotiation, but there is definitely a financial transaction that's underway, and thinking about it that way sometimes helps parents frame the conversation a little better.
Yeah, absolutely. I also would suggest to kind of formalize the process. Schools will say things like, sure, we'll listen to your appeal, and they give you a form to fill out, and there's a little paragraph block for you to write your unusual circumstances. And we suggest in that paragraph you say, see attached. And then you prepare a separate letter about a page, maybe a page and a half long, that goes along with that form. Don't call the school. Don't email the school. It's too easy for them to blow you off. You want to do a formalized letter. Send it up FedEx. Make them sign for it. Wait a couple of days, and then contact them to say, hey, I'll be up on school next week. Can we schedule a visit or something of the sort? And often we'll find that schools will send an email back after receiving that package to say, after careful consideration, we're pleased to offer you the following blah, 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 or not. And one of the cases we're dealing with right now is Brandeis, who is notoriously difficult to negotiate with, they say, no thanks. We have 10 more people just like you lined up right behind you willing to pay full price. So as long as you're willing to accept the fact that your financial offer may not move at all, but you're willing to put forth the effort, we think that an appeal makes sense in a lot of cases. I wanted to just share one other point, too, about rating retirement funds. I'd have to agree with John that rating retirement's not such a hot idea because, obviously, it can endanger your retirement. But one tool we would suggest running for folks is to run a retirement analysis right alongside your college cash flow models to say, if we were to beat up on retirement, how far can we go at that concept before it becomes unrecoverable? And one account that I think is kind of useful for paying for college is Roths. And we don't talk about that very often, but Roths are actually favorable for paying for college because you can withdraw from a Roth without a 10% penalty, provided it is done in the same year that you have the college expense, and all we will pay on that withdrawal is taxes. And because the principal in a Roth is already taxed, you're only paying taxes on the gains, which hopefully is a smaller number. So in order of progression, we'd say get your 529s first, and then maybe a Roth could come after that. John, you want to open up for some questions here?
That'd be great.
Okay, so folks, if you would like to flag John for a question and show up on our operator's screen, just press 5-star on your telephone. That will light up on our operator's control board. We'll unmute your line and proceed with your question. So, folks, once again, 5-star. Have a question for John or myself. Okay, we have some takers. Oh, yes, you're on.
Oh, wow, that was easy. So I have two questions. Number one, I wanted to address the question about when the aid letters come, but they don't really crystallize what the next two 3 years would look like. Like the packages that we're looking at show us what we would owe for this coming school year, but don't actually give us the amount of gift aid that we would have for subsequent years. So I wanted to find out how one goes about finding out what the next 3 years would look like.
Charles, I'll start, and then Charles, yeah, I'll supplement. So there are two things going on with this, and thank you for raising the point. One is that whatever financial aid award paperwork you filed to get this a letter, so either the FAFSA and or the CSS profile, you're going to need to do in each of the next years going forward, right through the senior year, so you get the package. So it's important for everyone to know that. The second part is that I would talk to the school about each one of those, and that was the point about the scholarships in particular. The need-based aid, like the, for instance, the Pell Grants and the SEOG Award, that generally comes, or not generally, it comes from the FAFSA form itself, and it's a generated, it's a formula generated award. So, and there's a cap at the federal level on that. So the first message to you is obviously make sure you follow up with the paperwork in the subsequent years. The second is I would ask the school right now which of these awards are likely to be for second, third, and fourth years, and then get an idea, of course, of how much loan they packaged into each one of those award letters. Charles, I think you would agree with me that it's most likely that the package that you have now was likely to be replicated in the years going ahead, but you want to, particularly with the scholarships and the grants, make sure that that's the case.
Yeah, absolutely, I'd agree. John, maybe you can talk to one point that I don't see so often, and maybe you see more in your bailiwick, is we have a lot of folks that ask, what's the likelihood that a scholarship won't be renewed in the second, third, and fourth year simply because they know they've got you, and the kid doesn't want to go to a different school? You know,
yeah,
that's my concern.
Yes, and I don't have any data on that, but I was on a panel on actually Saturday, and this exact question came up, and the panel agreed, and the point that I made was that it's unlikely the school is going to want to just do a straight out bait and switch on you. It's not in their best interest to do that. So for the most part, and there was a financial aid director on that panel with us as well, and she agreed with this point. The school really wants to try to keep the student. You know, their numbers about retention is important to them. So the idea that they would give you a very fat package for freshman year and then completely obliterate it for sophomore, junior, or senior year is fairly abnormal. It's not something that's in their best interest, and it's certainly, I can't guarantee you that they wouldn't do that, but I would definitely talk to the school to understand what the terms of the scholarships and grants are in particular. That's the one place where you have, the greatest possibility of having a negative surprise down the road.
Okay. That actually brings me to my other question, which is a brief one, which is a couple of these second look opportunities where they have accepted students come for the day have the opportunity to schedule and meet with a financial aid, administrator or whatever. Is that wise to do? Because I know you just said to put it in writing in a letter, but is it wise if you have this opportunity to show up face-to-face?
I think it is. Any contact you have with the office is could be only helpful.
Okay.
Right, and even if they say, here's an offer we'd like you to take a look at, there's nothing that says you have to sign and accept at that meeting. You have every
okay.
The information you gather there, take it back home, think on it a bit, do whatever appeal you feel is necessary if need be. But to rewind one sentence or two, in terms of them stopping aid in future years, I think really what they're getting at is not making a commitment to offers in the future years because we don't know what the financials will be. And it's entirely possible that, in the second year of your kid's education, all of a sudden you get a giant executive bonus or a huge stock windfall that might negate some of the needs you have. But providing that the majority of your offer is academic-based, achievement and merit-based, it's likely to be replicated in future.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Cool.
Do you have any other takers for questions there?
Hi. First question I had was, we're in a situation where the total cost of the school, they subtracted from that what our calculated expected family contribution was, and the difference was very little. That difference was made up by an offered federal loan, and so the balance, which was significant, was left for us to figure out how to finance, and I saw through your ideas of how to do that. My question is that in year two for my child, we have boys that are 1 year apart. So year two, my expected family contribution, I believe, will drop significantly because now we have two children in school. So I've used the net price calculators online to estimate, what that expected family contribution will be. And let's just use an example. Let's say it dropped by $25,000. In years two, three, and four, the school that right now I'm forced to almost subsidize completely myself, they identify themselves as being need-based, that they completely fulfill your need. Will that $25,000 be then offered from those schools typically as a grant award to meet my need because my expected family contribution for that child has dropped due to the addition of a second child in school?
Right. So I understand. John, you mind if I grab this one?
Please do.
So, sir, you're talking about the quintessential problem that we deal with, and that is that your impression of what you can afford to pay is dramatically different from what Uncle Sam says you can afford to pay. And so often, unfortunately, it is a big number, and it is a surprise, and it's something we have to deal with often. You're in the quintessential area where you have a large contribution that you have to fill basically on your own, but maybe that's a surprise and a large number that we weren't quite prepared for. The advice I can give you, this might sound, surface, but is to come in to see us, and we can talk a little bit more about that and figure out what's going on. And you can find our contact information at valark.com and in the emails we sent. That being said, most of the time, if you're a little short on savings and so forth, that's where we're going to loans to fund the shortfall that you have based on what the feds say you can afford to pay versus what you afford to pay. And that's where we get into that debt crisis story that I know John is trying to help us all avoid. The second part of your question relates to when we have a second student coming on board. Generally, what happens is your expected contribution will stay the same because your family financials have not changed much. That expected contribution is now divided between two separate students. So it is possible that you could see some more support in that story. But I will caution you that most of the time, the only additional support we're going to see when that happens is the additional capacity to borrow. And, John, do you have any thoughts you want to add on that?
No, Charles, I won't, because I think each family's circumstance is different. It's one of the complexities. It's very hard to generalize what the right answer is. So I think the comment you made is correct. The only other thing I will mention for folks who heard the net price calculator, and at mycollegecorner.com, there is a calculator there called Financial Aid Calculator, which allows you to do what this gentleman did, which is to calculate your family's expected family contribution. So there's a free resource there as well for folks who want to go and use that.
Awesome.
Because to this point, I'm trying to figure out if this amount, you know, what I'm going to be on the hook for over 4 years, is this amount times four, or will that be reduced by X $1,000 in years two, three, and four, and so my total expected outlay is significantly lower because I have two kids in school?
It won't be reduced per se. I'll just make up a number. Let's say your ability to pay is $25,000. We'll just say that's the case for a minute. And, you know, that's for one student. When you have two students come in, that $25,000 is going to be divided by the two kids. So each kid is going to be allocated $12,500 of ability to pay. But you personally, as a family, as a household, are still on the hook for that $25,000 total. So it's lucky.
Oh, no, I understand that. I know I need to do a calculation for both children. Like, I'm doing a full for now. I'm trying to figure out for this one child.
Yeah.
Understood. Is it going to be this number times four, or will it be this number subtracted a bit times, you know, three and added together?
Without getting deep into the weeds here on the call, give us a ring after the conference call at our office here, and we can dive more into your individual case. We're going to cruise on here. We've got a couple of questions in the wings, so we'll take our next question.
Hello?
Oh, yes, there you are. Hi.
Oh, great. So I've been a little bit hesitant in contacting colleges regarding the appeals process because I did hear from a couple of other parents that the schools want to hear directly from the applicants, you know, my son. And I just wanted to see if you,
that's not necessarily a blanket answer. Most of the appeals that we handle through our office, and John, jump in if you like here, 95% are prepared by the parents. Now, in some cases, the student will write a paragraph or so that kind of gets excerpted into the letter, but we think there's nothing wrong with it coming from the parents. It's rare for a student to sit down and write out a well-thought-out, informed, and well-written appeal letter. Yeah, I just don't see that.
Absolutely. Okay, great. Thank you. That was my only question.
Welcome. My pleasure.
Excellent presentation, so thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Doing well.
Good. My question is about a 529.
Okay.
So I have about $25,000 in a 529. I'm expecting the college to ask us to give that entire amount toward my son's first year of college. Is that correct? And how, and more broadly, how do colleges view the assets in a 529 in his name?
It's not exactly correct. It's a very common thought that, hey, wow, we've got a pile of money. They're going to ask me to turn that all over to pay for school. That's really not how the calculation is done. The calculation is done based on the combined assets and income that you have in your family, and that comes up with a number that says, here is, based on our understanding of you, your ability to pay. How you come up with the number to ability to pay is entirely up to you. They won't say you've got to go drain your 529, you've got to go drain your stock fund, or you have to go borrow. It's up to you to figure out how best to fund that need. Now, whether you raid your 529 or you borrow is entirely up to you. And there's a whole different model for what asset we use first, second, third, and so on.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit more about first, second, and third then?
Well, sure. You know, for instance, and this may be more in the weeds for offline, but in general, we suggest that you don't burn your 529 all in the first year.
Okay.
We suggest that you take whatever your savings and investment are and burn roughly a quarter of it per year. So a really rough sketch here, here's kind of the formula. You take cost of attendance, minus the scholarships and support that you've got from the school to become amount due by parents. Subtract one-fourth of your savings from the amount due by parents to arrive at the shortfall, and that shortfall is what you borrow. The reason we don't burn all of your savings in year number one is because we don't know what's going to happen in year two, three, and four. They could cut the scholarship. Trump could cut financial aid. We don't know. So we like to have a war chest that continues throughout the college years that allows us to have an asset that we can use to help manage unforeseen circumstances, including 4 years become six. 50% of the students don't graduate in 4 years. They graduate in six. So we may need a war chest that kind of gets through some of the later unforeseen circumstances.
That's worth the price of admission alone. Awesome. Thank you very much. I appreciate
my
that.
My pleasure. Glad to hear that. Hey, we still have a few more. Looks like a popular call. So, all righty, welcome. You're on the line.
Hello?
Yes, hi. How are you?
Oh, hi. Can you tell me a little bit more about the payment plans and how they work? Is there like a max amount, or can you choose an amount?
You can choose an amount. And in my experience with both my daughters, when the school sent the first invoice, there was an insert in there that talked about the payment plan that they offered through usually a third-party vendor. So your point, I think, is an excellent one and should be reinforced, and that is you don't have to use that payment plan as 100% funding for the amount that's unmet need part of that. You can, whatever you think is right for your circumstance and however you want to pay that, most, again, like I showed on the slide, if you have seen that, there are oftentimes either a division of the payment due in two payments, one in September, one in January, and more often, though, the payment plans are over a 10-month period. So start paying in September, make that monthly payment right through the end of the school year, basically.
Okay, great. Thank you. And I could see the college that I'm looking at does offer it, and it looks like it's about 10 months as well. So
terrific.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Hi, I have two separate questions. The first one is about tapping into life insurance cash values and what your...
Oh, my favorite topic. Yeah, okay.
I have roughly a cash value of roughly $75,000, and I'm wondering what your... Most of the stuff I've read is kind of negative on that. I'm wondering your opinion and the different ways of using that.
Right. So I'm gonna say I'm very positive on it, and I might be one of those advisors that does things backwards from everybody else, but we think it makes perfect sense. We think it's the right way to do it. And it starts with the premise that life insurance is a horrible way to save for college. As much as your insurance agent says it's a great way and it doesn't show up on a financial aid form, they're only half right. It doesn't show up on a financial aid form, but because of the cost of insurance and the taxation on withdrawal, it's not efficient. It's better to use a 529 for whatever state you reside in. That's probably the best answer. Now that that's water over the bridge, the second part is to say, well, what kind of life insurance do we need and how much do we need? And the thought is that as you get older, you probably need less and less life insurance. And I know life insurance agents out there are going to yell at me for that because they're always going to say everything costs more in the future, so you have to have more insurance. I don't believe that for a second. Because as our kids graduate from school and as we pay down our mortgage and as we save for retirement, we have assets and our liabilities are reducing, so we probably have less need for insurance. If we accept all of that, the next piece is to say, well, probably it's a good idea to surrender the insurance, take the cash value, pay a little bit of taxes on it, put it into your 529 plan, probably get a tax deduction on the deposit, grow truly double tax-free from that point forward. Then we go back and replace the life insurance with inexpensive term, take the savings and premium, put that into your 529 too. And every calculation I've ever done on that says that that's way more efficient than anything else. The bottom line becomes, are there any other resources that we would use? And if there are no other resources, then yeah, I think surrendering insurance and going through that process can make a lot of sense.
Okay, is there such a thing as just taking a loan against if you want to keep the policy going, taking a loan against it?
Yes, you can. And there are some advantages to a loan, but the major disadvantage to a loan is in order for the loan to be paid off with a tax-free, event, meaning no taxes, you have to die with the policy, which means if you plan to live for many years, you're going to be paying for that life insurance for many, many years. And while the cost of the loan may end up being a net zero cost for reasons I won't bore you with, the cost of maintaining the insurance for the next 25 years when you have a reducing need for insurance doesn't make sense. I'd rather
take
the money, pay a little bit of taxes, transition to a chat or whatnot, and carry on from there.
Understood. Thank you. Could I ask one other unrelated question?
Of course. Yes.
I was surprised to see that the from the federal government, this supplemental FSEOG seems to be, different from school to school, and I'm wondering if that's going to differ from year to year. First of all, why is it so different between schools? And secondly, should I expect that to change from year to year?
John, do you want to talk to that?
Charles, I'm sorry. I don't have a very deep knowledge of the I mean, I know the program, but I can't I can't offer that advice.
Sure, no worries. So what happens here is the feds take their financial aid pile of money and they push it down to the schools to distribute how they see fit. So each school, and you'll see this for even different types of awards, it'll be a different amount for each school. And you scratch your head saying, I thought that was a federal program that's consistent across the board. Well, it's not, because the schools have the ability to administer those dollars to attract whom they want based on how they see fit. As soon as we understand that, now we know that there's a game being played here where they are trying to position themselves to offer money to people they really want to attract and maybe not so much for others. That now becomes an appealable point where you can say, hey, at school A, we were offered, I don't know, X amount for the FSEOG, but at school B, you offered less. And if you would only kindly match what school A sent for the FSEOG, we would be very interested in attending your school. And that goes to the negotiation process. And that also goes year to year, depending on what federal funds are available and who they're trying to attract and your financial situation, has it changed or not. It's not reliable to rely on the FSEOG to be the same number every year. It should be close, but not necessarily exactly the same.
Okay. That's good information. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. So we're running short on time here. We're going to do one last call for questions, and then we'll have to wrap it up. So 5-star on your phone if you have any questions. Looks like the board is clear. So, John, thank you, sir. This was probably one of the best conference calls we've had in many years, and I thank you for that.
Well, thank you, Charles. It's great to work with you, and I really appreciate all the terrific questions. And hopefully we can solve some problems and do it again if it's necessary to do that. So thanks again for the opportunity.
Absolutely.
Thank you all for participating.
Sounds great. And folks, if you need to reach us for any reason, Valark.com is where we can find us. And for now, that concludes our call for this afternoon. Thank you all, and have a great weekend. Bye-bye.